All right. Well, welcome everybody. We got a baby boom going on in Raleigh. I see Brooklyn's here. I haven't seen Brooklyn yet. Maybe this is her first time. We got Connor, Adalia, I think that's her name. I'm not sure if she's here today or not, but that's a baby boom here in Raleigh. It's great. So this message is going to live a little different today for me. I'm going to tell you right up front, I was assigned this exact message by Mr. Scott. And if you like titles, you can write this down. The title of this is 20 Reasons Why Gary Petty is Great. So I don't know why he wanted me to talk about this, but no, that's not true. Look, if you're listening to this recording, you missed the announcements. It's just the whole, there's a story behind it. So I want to use an attention getter today because it is an assigned topic. I'll get to that in a second. So I was trying to think, how do I get everybody's attention? Let's go with politics. People seem to be interested in that. And, you know, last message, if you were here, which in Raleigh, you know, we get a lot of people, maybe you weren't here. Last message I gave you, probably thinking, oh, yeah, politics. I know. I remember Ben. He's that capitalist pig. His whole last message was this subversive capitalist message. What a capitalist pig, which I think is ironic because this week, Ian, my youngest son, he's reading the book Animal Farm in school. So he said, hey, can we watch the movie? So I watched the movie with them, and it was the cartoon version. And if you know what Animal, has anybody read Animal Farm or watched Animal Farm? It's a classic. But it's basically an allegory on how communism rose to power in the Soviet Union, the pitfalls of it. And the irony here is the leaders were not capitalist pigs, they were socialist pigs. And one of the great, I'm leading into this, one of the greatest pitfalls of communism is that in several ways, it just ignores the natural law and order that God created. You know, some of what God has created is just, it's invisible, but it's universal. It's there. You can't deny it. But also, the one we're going to look at today is also coded directly into his Ten Commandments. And the one we're going to cover today is both a natural law and a moral law and one of God's laws, and that is, thou shalt not steal. Now, what do I say that it's a natural law? Why say, well, stealing's a natural law? Well, has anyone in here either had a kid or been around kids? Pretty much everybody. So if you've got a toddler, and a couple toddlers are playing with a toy, and one toddler's toy, it's his toy or her toy, and the other toddler takes the toy, what happens? Well, you usually get an absolute fit. You know, that is my toy, and where does this sense of injustice come from? You know, not just the sense of injustice, but the sense of possession. Where does that come from? You know, animals don't really have this. I'm around a lot of animals, and we have all kinds of animals, and they just really don't have the concept of possession, about a sense of property. They might have some territorialism, but they don't say, if I'm a horse, this is my saddle, and that horse should not have my saddle. Maybe somebody will correct me after services, but I haven't seen that with my animals. That's just, they don't have this sense of it. Animals do not exhibit an innate sense of justice and injustice, but humans do, even the very smallest little toddlers. Where does that come from? You know, C.S. Lewis, I think I've referenced this before, but I think it's a great argument in his famous book, Mere Christianity, that the largest proof of God, C.S. Lewis was an atheist turned Christian, and the largest proof of God is actually in this innate sense of justice and natural moral law that we seem to have embedded in us from birth. And where does that seed come from? Why does everybody have it? Why is it universal? Again, my point today was really not to argue capitalism versus communism. It was just to try to get your attention a little bit. But what I do is cover the eighth commandment. Thou shalt not steal. And we're going to look a little bit at that commandment and why it's a natural law and some other things about it. Now, as an aside, you'll notice this is one of the commandments. If you've been here recently, you say, hey, we're going through all the commandments. Most of them we have. And a little backstory on that, you know, Mr. Scott asked all of us, hey, like to do the commandments, you can volunteer. So I'm like, commandments? I do stories. Commandments? How am I going to tell a story with a commandment? So I just sat quietly in the background, which didn't work at all. So now I got assigned adultery, which we'll get to at some point, and stealing. How am I going to get up here and talk for 40 minutes about a four-word commandment, thou shall not steal. Thankfully, we did another song, so we're eating up the time a little bit. Thou shall not steal. How can you get any kind of sermon length out of that? That's a pretty obvious one, right? Don't take something not yours. But what I want to do today is really dive deep into that. What does that mean? Look at some of the broader principles that are found in this simple commandment. And then why it matters. Like, why is this a big deal? I've got 7 points. We'll go through those points relatively quickly, but there's more. I'm sure you can find more. But we're going to cover 7 points on why it, what are some of the broader principles and why it matters. So you can find this in Exodus 20 and verse 15, or Deuteronomy 5 and verse 19. Those are both where the Ten Commandments are found. And it says identically in both accounts in the New King James Version, you shall not steal. Thou shalt not steal. Four words. And the word used here for steal is the Hebrew word ganav. Ganav, some people pronounce it. According to Strong's dictionary, that Hebrew word means to carry away, to secretly take, to get by stealth. The root of it literally means to thieve, but by implication, to deceive, to carry away, to secretly bring, to steal, to get by stealth. So a couple elements there that you see. It's more than just taking what's not yours. It's the manner in which it's done. To be hidden, to be stealthful, to be deceptive. We'll look at that. Now, broadly speaking, stealing falls into two categories. Active stealing and passive stealing. You can categorize these, and we could really spend all day long going down to all these little things. I just want to broadly cover a few elements of what is stealing. Active stealing and passive stealing, we'll put them in those two categories. Active stealing, aggressively, willfully, maliciously, it takes taking what somebody belongs to someone else through a variety of means. That's, we'll start with that one. You know, in Leviticus 6, if you want to turn there, you can. We find several forms of active theft that are identified. In fact, the Old Testament has a lot to talk about on stealing. Leviticus 6, and we'll read here in verses 1 through 7, it says, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, when a person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord, we'll come back to the part of this that's faith, because faith will be one of the 7 points, but you see it right here in Leviticus 6, when this person sins and acts unfaithfully against the Lord, and deceives his companion in regard to a deposit or security entrusted to him, or through robbery, or if he is extorted from his companion, or has found what was lost and lied about it and sworn falsely, so that he sins in regard to any one of the things a man may do, then it shall be when he sins and becomes guilty that he shall restore what he took by robbery, or what he got by extortion, or the deposit which was entrusted to him, or the lost thing which he found, or anything about which he swore falsely, he shall make restitution for it in full, and add to it 1/5 more. He shall give it to the one to whom it belongs on the day he presents his guilt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for him before the Lord. And then he shall be forgiven any one of the things which he may have done to incur guilt. Now, there's a lot of other scriptures here with a lot of rules and designations around restitution and different manners of restitution. You can see one found here. I used Bible.org. I'm going to obviously reference who I've got. I'm not going to steal any thing that I got. But I thought Bible.org did a good job of kind of listing out the different forms of theft that are found here in Leviticus and in some other places in the original Old Testament, the Torah. The first one here is embezzlement. Embezzlement is basically the misuse or misappropriation of something that's been entrusted to us. We see that directly in verse 2 there in Leviticus 6. Embezzlement is a violation of trust. You know, someone's been given something for their good keeping, and they basically take it and use it in a different way, usually for selfish purposes. So embezzlement is stealing. Robbery, this one's pretty obvious. Robbery is just the act of taking what belongs to another. We saw that also in Leviticus 6. You know, robbery's broad. It covers a lot of different types of stealing, but really generally it's taking something that's not yours, usually by force, and stealing itself, again, robbery, and it suggests stealth. So it doesn't have to be overt force. So pickpocket, for example, uses stealth. A burglar does that. They sneak in when you're not there. Fraud could also be identified here within this general robbery, because fraud involves getting what belongs to someone else by deception. Here, the victim often gives what is stolen to the thief, thinking that doing so will be profitable, but the only one that profits is the thief. That's fraud. Another one is extortion. Extortion is where you gain possession of another person's property by the illicit use of authority or of force. Again, charging an excessive price here. Extortion basically means you're really taking advantage of someone else. We'll see that in one of the principles that we look at here. In Luke 3, Jesus addresses extortion. I'll read it, Luke 3 and verse 13 and 14. When he's addressing, I believe, the centurion, or at least some soldiers, he says, "Collect no more than what you have been ordered to." And some soldiers were questioning him, saying, "And what about us? What shall we do?" And he said to them, "Don't take many from anyone by force or accuse anyone falsely, and be content with your wages." Because in that day and age, it was quite frequent that you would see extortion being done by the soldiers. So Jesus addressed that directly. Another one is kidnapping. Kidnapping is found, you find this in the Old Testament in several places. Deuteronomy 24 is one of them, and verse 7. Kidnapping was quite frequently done in that day and age, and unfortunately it's been done in the modern age as well. And usually it's done for the same reason. Somebody wants to take someone, sell them, and profit from it. That is stealing. Awful stealing, because it's not a transactional loss. It is a permanent loss to the victim. And there's a lot of other active forms of stealing, but I think you get the general overall concept. But let's talk a little about passive forms of stealing, because with active, it's you can kind of see it. You're taking a possession of somebody else, but passive theft is the failure to give to another what belongs to them or is due them. Maybe a little more subtle. It's still stealing, though. So let me give you a few other examples that we find directly in the Bible. Exodus 22 in verses 1 through 15, and then in verse 5 basically cover this. A man's negligence, which results in a loss to his neighbor. You know, so in Exodus 22, it talks about negligence, where the neighbor doesn't take care of the property. Well, that requires restitution. So, you know, it uses the example, if a man's pasture land has been grazed bare, and therefore he lets his animal loose that it grazes on his neighbor's pasture, consuming that grass, the negligent man that's passive stealing. Another one we find in Leviticus 6, we saw it there, is a man's failure to return something lost to its owner. You know, in our day and age, we say, oh, finders keepers. Well, not really. That's, you know, finders keepers, losers weepers. That's just an excuse for theft. If it's somebody else's that they lost, we found it, we know it's not ours, we know it's theirs, we don't return it, that's stealing, passive stealing. We saw another, there's an example of that you can see in Deuteronomy 22 and verses 1 through 4, covers that specifically. Another is passive stealing is failure to give what belongs to another. So the example, classic example here is, and we see this in Leviticus 19 and verse 13, and Deuteronomy 24 and verses 14 through 15, is where a day laborer is not paid at the end of the day. So the master doesn't pay out what is owed on the agreed schedule. For an employer to keep the laborer's wages, that was agreed upon, that wage rightfully should have gone to the worker by how they agreed, that's passive stealing. You know, we see this also in tithes, right? There's, you can see the addresses it directly in Deuteronomy 18 and verses 1 through 8, and 26 and verses 9 through 13. We also see this in Malachi, where God says, you know, he accuses the nation of Israel of stealing. They say, what have we stolen from you? And you know, all is his. He's asked for the tithes. So we see that's another form. Failure to giving what belongs to another is stealing, including God. There are a ton more. We could go on and on, but I think the general concept is the important idea here. There's a lot more in the Old Testament around this law. In fact, when I was researching this, it's just entire chapters on how to make restitution, whether it was active or passive theft. You know, the exact descriptions of how to do that. There's instructions on the penalties and how to handle very specific corner cases. There are stories about those in the Old Testament who broke this law. And then we see the consequences for them individually, but not just them individually. Often, the Israel as a nation, or Judah, suffered for that. We see that in the stories. You know, if you read through the major and minor prophets, so like Isaiah, Jeremiah, all the minor prophets, if you read through those repeatedly, it talks about basically the rotting culture of Israel and Judah. Now, first and foremost, this was due to idolatry. That is clearly the number one thing that you read about. But often not far behind it, stealing, robbery, was a part of this culture of anti-God that had infected them. You know, taking from the poor, the greed, this concept of just selfishness and taking and taking, taking. You read throughout the minor and major prophets, it's one of the big, big sins that just absolutely corrupted those nations. You know, when it really comes down to it, let's boil this back down to something simple. Basically, with this law, God is saying, look, don't wrongfully take what isn't yours, or give due where you owe. And as we started with, we all have this sense of justice around ownership kind of innately already in us. Toddlers do. The problem that we usually run into is when we start rationalizing. We start rationalizing of why it's not really stealing. And if you find yourself starting to, if that innate sense of justice comes in you and you start arguing with it to rationalize, that is the red flag that you are probably about to break this command. I didn't have that as one of the points, but it's probably one of the best points you can have. I have done that, and I find myself often doing that. You can rationalize anything. And with stealing, that's usually that's the place where you cross over. It's a gray area. Not really. I'm going to use this for good, you know. We've probably all done it to one degree or another, but I'd say as you inspect and watch yourself in your own life, that's the thing to look for. If you have that little argument with your conscience and your innate sense of justice with what you want to do, then you know, I need to look at this a little closer. So let's look at some principles here that are found in this law that I think are very practical, also very relevant to our Christian walk, beyond just the obvious. The first principle here, which I found notable, is that this law, instructed in the original Ten Commandments, the first principle that I found out of this is it implies that human beings are allowed, in fact, expected to own or possess material items, animals, land. And I think that's a significant point. Now, obviously, in Western, especially American culture, that pendulum can swing way too far. But, you know, you see it in today's society that everybody wants to move, or I shouldn't say everybody, a lot of people want to swing the pendulum the other way. You know, we see throughout God's instruction to Israel in the Torah that he has all kinds of guidance around this topic. He provides all kinds of clarity, definitions, boundaries around possession of land, goods, animals. He tells Israel to go possess the land and all that is in it. Why does he do that? Why is this embedded in the human experience? Why is God telling us, I want you to do that? Because God owns all things. And if someday we are to grow to be like him, we have to learn how to possess things, handle ownership, stewardship. But what we have to learn is how to use it in the model of how he does it. And we'll talk about that in some of these other principles. But the first point is, embedded in this law implies that God designed it to be this way, that we could possess material items, possess land. Second principle, this law teaches us a basic principle to respect other people's property. How we treat other people's stuff is how we show love and respect to other people. It's a proxy for it. And in this day and age, I think this is a big one to learn. Because a lot of people just don't respect other people's property. And when you don't, when your property is not respected, you have this innate sense of violation. Where does that come from? Do you feel loved when somebody else doesn't respect your property? Takes something, borrows it from you, never gives it back, damages it. You can't say, I love my neighbor, if you carelessly borrow something from them, break it, and then offer no restitution. It's just wrong. So again, God gives us this simple law that can teach us so much about the purpose of his law, which is how to love him and our neighbors. And we can do that by how we respect each other's property. And this law gives a lot of guidance around that, teaches us that as a principle. So that's the second principle. The third principle that this law teaches us is that we are responsible, as we are able, to provide for ourselves and our families. Living in faith to God that as we work, as we are able, it's actually he will provide and allow us to model after him to be a giver. And so we found this concept actually in the New Testament. I'm going to read two scriptures here. Paul writes in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. He says, "For even when we were with you, we commanded you this. If anyone will not work, neither shall he eat." It teaches us that we should do something useful. You know, like it or not, the Bible teaches us that we're to try to earn a living by working as we are able. The world doesn't just owe us a living. We're not entitled to it. Now, there are circumstances where you're not able, and you know that's the whole principle that we should be working together to share with those who are not. But we shouldn't take advantage of that either on the other side. That's also stealing. Ephesians 4 and verse 2, which is a pretty critical scripture when it comes to this law in the New Testament. Ephesians 4 and verse 2, Paul says, Let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need. You know, in this small verse, we see the glimpse of kind of the whole point of ownership, possession, and stewardship. Work, possess, own. Why? So you can give, and in doing so, become like God. You know, when it all comes down to it, and I give another message on this, and we talk about this every week and lots of messages, when it really comes down to it, there are givers and there are takers. And this law helps to shake it out. On that concept, the fourth principle that we see here. Satan was the original thief. He is the original taker. And God, on contrast, is the ultimate giver. The concept and law of stealing actually teaches us a lot about the nature of God, and to turn the contrast 180 degrees, the nature of our enemy. Which one will we model our lives after? Are you a giver? Are you a taker? Let's look into this a little bit deeper. And then we will get to a story, because I got to use a story somewhere. John 10 and verse 10. John 10 and verse 10. I want to analyze this a little deeper. John 10 and verse 10. Jesus is teaching here, and he teaches an incredibly important message. He's talking before this about being the good shepherd. And he says in John 10 and verse 10, he says, the thief comes not but for to steal, to kill, and to destroy. I am come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly. The thief is here to take. I am here to give. Now the thief in this, and you can read different analysis, but the thief, the ultimate thief, is the enemy, Satan the devil. You know, some commentaries will say, he's talking about, you know, the Pharisees. Okay, well, maybe. Well, they're just modeling their behavior here as the, if that's even the right interpretation, they're modeling the thief, Satan. He wants to come into your life and destroy all the good things, your happiness, your health, your finances, your marriage, your kids, your job. That's what he wants to do. And if you don't think that, then you're just opening up the door. Now, the word thief here, actually the Greek, if you read the Greek, it actually comes from the word klepto, which we use that, as a modern phrase, klepto, right? Well, I'll get to that in a second, what we use it for. Usually it's a kleptomaniac, and we'll talk about that. But klepto is the original Greek, which means simply to steal. But it gives kind of the picture, the Greek word builds out the picture of a bandit, a pickpocket, a thief who is so artful in the way he steals that you almost don't detect it. That's what it describes. The word klepto in Greek implies. You know, often Satan injects thoughts into a person's mind to steal his peace, his joy, even his beliefs. And the word klepto describes kind of this thief's uncontrollable urge to get in your pocket and steal it. Take something that's not his. You know, kleptomaniac. Someone who just has an obsession, an impulse to steal at all times. That's, you know, we hear the word klepto. If you, that kid is a klepto. Well, that means he's constantly just, he can't think about anything about taking somebody else's stuff. And that is how Satan the devil is. He is a kleptomaniac. All he's doing all day long is thinking of how he can steal. You know, but this verse I think is interesting because it says, this thief came not only to steal, but he comes to kill. Now, I found this on, I found a good commentary on John 10 by the Renner. I think it was the Renner Ministries. It was just good. It used the Greek words. There's not a lot else in it, but I wanted to, again, give reference to where I did borrow some. The Greek word here, like you think it means to kill, take someone's life, but the Greek word is thuo, T-H-U-O, which actually means to sacrifice. And it really refers to like kind of the sacrificial giving of animals on the altar originally. You know, but it could mean to sacrifice, to surrender, giving up something that's precious and dear to you. That's the actual world. So kill, but it's a certain, the thief comes to steal, but then to also to kill. And the way Jesus uses this word here, if the thief just can't take everything in your life, if he just can't steal it, he's going to find a way for you to give it up. And that's, I think, what Jesus is implying here. First, the thief is going to take. If he can't take it from you, can't pick your pocket, he's going to get you to give it up. We're going to look in the story that I'm going to give you of a model of this, of someone who played this out. You know, the thief cannot bear the fact that you have any kind of blessing. So he's going to try to convince you to give everything you possess and love. He doesn't want you to have it. Try to get you in a situation where you on your own conclude that you have to sacrifice something valuable and important in your own life. And lastly, Jesus says here that the thief comes to destroy. And the word destroy is apollumi, which basically means to annihilate, to destroy, to obliterate. It carries this idea that it's ruined, trashed, devastated, wasted, destroyed. The thief wants to steal. He wants, for whatever he can't take from you, you to give it up. Because at the end of the day, he wants to obliterate you. But Jesus went on to say, I am come that they may have life, and that they may have it more abundantly. The word here for life was Zoe, like the name Zoe, which suggests a life that is filled with vitality. And the word abundantly is the Greek word periosis, which it means to be above, beyond what's regular, extraordinary, even exceeding, superabundance. What a contrast and comparison that Jesus gives us in one short verse there. The devil comes to steal. He comes to kill, make you give it up. And he comes to obliterate and destroy and annihilate. But Jesus, Satan, the thief, is a taker. But Jesus comes to give life. He's a giver. And he's to give us life beyond what we can even imagine. That's a simple concept, but this law embedded in the original Ten Commandments draws out that contrast between the taker and the giver and who we're going to model our actions after. The fifth principle builds on this. Stealing's a gateway drug. It's a gateway drug. It corrupts the soul. Maybe not the first time you do it. Maybe not the first time you take it. But it's a gateway drug. And it corrupts the soul. Here I want to look at a story that we don't look at too often in Scripture. And that is Judas Iscariot. Because Judas Iscariot took the gateway drug. And then, as we just covered, and we'll see it here in his life, there was stealing, there was killing. He gave up and surrendered what he had on his own, and he was obliterated. So let's just look at his story a little bit, because actually the Bible, he's a popular character in you know, modern movies or modern, you know, media, but the Bible doesn't say actually a whole lot about him. So what can we see on Judas and see in his story, and what can we learn about this law? What can we learn about what we just read, or the prior principle about the taker and the giver? So let's, if you would, turn to John 12 and verses 1 through 6. This is really the primary thing we know about Judas. Here it says in John 12 and verses 1 through 6, note, not long after John 10 and verse 10, what we just read about, you know, what the thief does and what Jesus was here to do. Not long after that, and right before the Passover, it says 6 days before the Passover celebration began. And I read New King James Version for most of what we're reading here, but when it goes to story mode, I'll read New Living Translation. 6 days before the Passover celebration began, Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. And a dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus among those who ate with him. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume, made from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it, wiping his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance. But then Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would soon betray him, which, by the way, almost every place you find Judas, it has this qualifier. It's one of the main things that every time he's mentioned, the disciple who would soon betray him, the one who would betray, the betrayer, said, hey, that perfume was worth a year's wages. It should have been sold, and we should have given the money to the poor. You see some rationalization going on here? And then in verse 6 it says, not that he cared for the poor, because he was a thief. And since he was in charge of the disciples' money, he often stole some for himself. Now, what do you actually know about Judas? Like I said, Scripture doesn't really tell us that much about him. There's no description of his conversion or turning to follow Christ as one of the 12 disciples. We get that with a lot of the disciples. Nothing on that with Judas. Most every time he's referenced as Judas, the one who would betray Jesus, or Judas Iscariot. Now, it's debated by scholars of what Iscariot means. It's really two general accepted things that they conclude. First one is it means a man from Kerioth. Kerioth was a city in Judah. Which notable there would imply that he's likely maybe the only non-Galilean disciple. I don't know if that's significant or not, but perhaps. Iscariot could also possibly be a connection with the Sicarii, which at that time was a Jewish nationalist movement that was opposed to Roman rule. I don't know. Maybe that one, they made that one fit. I don't know. But that kind of makes more sense. Perhaps if that's accurate, it provides a clue as to why Judas had a motive in his treachery. I mean, you could imagine if he was part of this, you know, like very, very radical Jewish nationalist movement that was opposed to Roman rule, he could have attached himself to Jesus as the Messiah, expecting to overthrow the Romans. And then when he saw that just wasn't going to happen, this guy's a fraud, and he turned on him. Maybe, I don't know. It doesn't tell us. We can speculate, which is what I'm doing, but we don't know. Why was Judas in charge of the money? Doesn't tell us. We don't know. What we know is that he was a thief. He stole. That's what it tells us that we can know for sure. We know he took a gateway drug that corrupted his soul. Let's read on here. We'll see a little bit more in the story of Judas. Matthew 26, and I'll read in verse 7. Matthew 26 and verse 7, it says, And this is a very similar story to what we just read. And again, scholars will debate, is it the same or not the same? My own opinion is it's probably the same, but regardless, it's notable here what we're about to read. While he was eating, a woman came with a beautiful alabaster jar of expensive perfume and poured it over his head. And the disciples, here it says, were indignant when they saw this. What a waste, they said. It could have been sold for a high price and the money given to the poor. John tells us that's what Judas said. Here in Matthew, doesn't specify which disciple. Maybe another disciple latched onto that rationality. Maybe that other disciple was genuine in that rationality. I don't know. But what John tells us was Judas said it, and he wasn't sincere about it because he was going to steal it. Verse 10, Jesus, aware of this, replied, "Why criticize this woman for doing such a good thing to me?" And then he goes on and kind of describes she's going to be remembered. And verse 14, then Judas Iscariot, one of the 12 disciples, right after this, like the moment this happened, went to the leading priests. They didn't go to him. He went to them and asked, "How much will you pay me to betray Jesus to you?" And they gave him 30 pieces of silver. And from that time on, Judas began looking for an opportunity to betray Jesus. It implies that what we read in John, when he was very upset that this money was being wasted, was kind of the moment that he said, "That's it, I'm done with this guy. He's a fraud. I'm going to go turn him in. How much are these people going to get? What other profit can I make on this?" Now let's go to John 13. And we read some of these verses quite often around the Passover time or at Passover. But this is, I remember, we're pretty much reading what we know about Judas here. There's not a lot else in Scripture. John 13 and verses 21 through 30. I'll skip through a little bit of this or go, you know this story. John 13, 21, 30. It says, "Now Jesus was deeply troubled and he exclaimed, 'I tell you the truth, one of you will betray me.' And disciples all looked at each other, wondering whom he could mean. They didn't know. And the disciple that Jesus loved, which was John, the writer here, was sitting next to Jesus at the table. Simon Peter motioned him and said, 'Ask him, who's he talking about?' So Peter leaned over to Jesus and said, 'Who is it? Who's going to betray you, Lord?' Jesus responded, probably again under his breath, 'It is the one to whom I give the bread I dip in the bowl.' And when he had dipped it, he gave it to Judas, son of Simon Iscariot," which also again implies that it was probably a town, but maybe it was part of a movement. "When Judas had eaten the bread, Satan entered into him." Satan was already influencing him. Why? He was taking a gateway drug. And Jesus told him, "Judas, hurry and do what you're going to do." Now, none of the others at the table knew what Jesus meant. Since Judas was their treasurer, some thought Jesus was telling him, you know, go and take care, pay for the food, maybe give some of the money to the poor. So Judas left at once, going out into the night. The disciples here are describing, I mean, John's writing here, they just didn't know. Like, there weren't a lot of signs. There weren't a lot of clues that Judas was going to betray Jesus. And we see, I'm going to flip to Matthew 26. Same story, same flow. Going to the Matthew 26 version of it in verse 47. And Jesus, you know, at this point has gone out. He's left in the meal. They're out in the garden. And it says here, and Jesus was talking to the disciples. And even as Jesus said this in verse 47, Judas, one of the 12 disciples, arrived with a crowd of men armed with swords and clubs. They had been sent by leading priests and elders of the people. The traitor, Judas, had given them a prearranged signal. "You will know which one to arrest when I greet him with a kiss." And so Judas came straight to Jesus. You almost imagine him looking him right in the eye. And he said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and he gave him a kiss. Jesus said, "My friend, go ahead and do what you have come for." And at that point, they grabbed Jesus and arrested him. It's a really, if you paint the picture in your own mind, it's just an incredibly heartbreaking story. This guy had spent likely years with Jesus. He saw all the miracles we read about. He saw the good. He saw that this guy had never sinned. And he sold him out. How did that happen? Well, how did he get to that point? We don't know. What we do know is that Scripture says he stole. He took something that wasn't his. He took just a little bit of that drug and it corrupted him. Matthew 27, we'll keep reading on here. Verse 1. This is after the trial at the high priest. "Very early in the morning, the leading priests and the elders of the people met again." This is where, you know, they beat up Jesus the night before. You know, they accused him of blasphemy. They met that morning, the leading priests and the elders, to lay plans for putting Jesus to death. And they bound him, led him away, and took him to Pilate, the Roman governor. Why did they do that? Because they couldn't sentence him to death. They had to send him to Pilate. It says in verse 3, and it's just, again, heartbreaking. When Judas, who had betrayed him, realized that Jesus had been condemned to die, he was filled with remorse. So what does that tell us? I don't know exactly, but it seems like Judas thought he was betraying Jesus and they were going to arrest him and he was just going to be punished. Doesn't seem to, it implies that Judas did not realize they were going to condemn him to death. That doesn't make it any different. He completely betrayed him. But it says here, when Judas, who had betrayed him, realized that Jesus had been condemned to die, he was filled with remorse. So he took the 30 pieces of silver back to the leading priests and elders. "I have sinned," he declared, "for I have betrayed an innocent man." Their response, callously, "What do we care?" they retorted. "That's your problem." And Judas threw the silver coins down in the temple, and he went out and hanged himself. So, very sad conclusion to a story. But what I wanted to get out of this is, you may have had some other conceptions about Judas, but this is pretty much what the Bible gives us about him. And why do we spend so much time on that today? Why did I inject so much in that? Well, if you take away anything from this message that you remember years from now, it's that stealing is a gateway drug that corrupts your soul. Because basically in this entire account of Jesus, Judas, who sold out and betrayed the Son of God, all we're really told about the seeds of his corruption were that he stole. And my guess is it started with some rationality. He was doing something. Oh, we can use this money in the cause to fund the overthrow of the Romans. Or, I mean, that's what the Messiah's cause is anyways. We have extra here. I can pay it back later. I am doing God's work with this money. I don't know. I'm just implying here. I don't know how it started. But the basic formula for theft usually starts with small, like leaven, rationalizing why it's okay, and then it grows. It's like a gateway drug. It doesn't kill you the first time. Maybe it doesn't even harm you the first time, but the second time and third time, and it grows and it expands. And here in the example of Judas, we see exactly what the original thief does to ultimately destroy. What we read in John 10 and verse 10. First, he steals. That's what the thief does. He steals. He takes from your pocket. He makes us just like him. He gets us stealing. That's even better. Then, if that's not enough, he comes to kill or to have us choose to sacrifice away whatever he has not stolen. Judas goes from stealing to shaming his character and integrity to turning to greed and taking, and then decides his next step is to turn Jesus and betray him to basically sacrifice him. At which point, Satan, the master thief, has stolen, killed, and all that's left is the inevitable outcome. Destruction. Total destruction. And this is so brilliant by Satan. Not only does he destroy Judas, boom, he gets a 2-for-1. In his evil genius, surely he also believes that he's now destroyed the Son of God, as he's condemned to death by the actions of the human thief, Judas. Because you see, stealing is a gateway drug to the corruption and destruction of your soul. But what's great about this story is that Jesus gives us a great contrast, just like we saw in John 10 and verse 10, to the thief. He's the life giver. He's the good shepherd. And shortly after we see the thief in human action through Judas, ironically, what happens instead is that in the end, it actually enabled the plan of God in having the Son of God pay the penalty for all of mankind's sins, crucified, an ever greater irony between two thieves, which ultimately paved a way of reconciliation and salvation, and again, ironically, victory over the master thief, Satan himself, forever. Giving always triumphs over taking. So that's the fifth one. Judas is a living color of a gateway drug of stealing that corrupts your soul, that plays out the giver versus taker that we saw in John 10. The sixth principle, there's only two more, I know. A four-word commandment, I'm still going. Sixth principle, stealing is an act that is completely contrary to the character of God, much like what we just talked about, but it's a point on its own. Stealing is an act that is completely contrary to the character of God. You know, perhaps the reason why God hates stealing so much is that it is a crime which completely contradicts his character. God is gracious, the thief is greedy. God gives, the thief takes. God responds to the cries of the needy. That thief sees the needy as an easy victim. Nothing could be more contrary to the graciousness of God than the cruelty of the thief. You know, stealing, we often think it's just a sin against our neighbor, but it is a sin against God. It's against your neighbor also. It can be against your own people or nation or family. And ultimately, it's a sin against yourself. Then finally, the seventh principle is like almost every other commandment that we find. When it really comes down to it, stealing is all about faith. You know, lying breaks trust, for sure. Lying does break trust. You can't trust somebody who's lied to you. But stealing's worse. It's a trust destroyer. Now think about an example. If you're in a community and somebody's stealing, it's not one person now that you don't trust. You don't know who it is, right? Remember, stealing is stealthful. It's artful. Nothing can break a community's trust more than theft or a thief in the midst. Because then everyone else starts to wonder, who's the thief? Can I trust them? Can I trust that? It's more than one person involved. Thus, the sense of trust which binds a group together can easily be destroyed. But really, when you get down to it, what's the motive to steal? Why steal? At the end of the day, it's simply because you don't trust God to take care of your needs, or you don't trust his word. And that's why you start rationalizing. I'm going to do it. Because you don't trust God. And that's the reason, you know, it says that we're not going to read a lot of scriptures, but there's a lot of scriptures in the New Testament that says, these folks will not be in my kingdom. These folks will not be there in the resurrection. And it's thieves, robbers. Why? There's two reasons. One, because one who steals, he's of his father, the devil's character, just like we read about. He's a taker. God can't have that in the kingdom. It won't work. The whole sense of community won't work. You can't have a thief. You can't have a taker. And two, you can't be saved without faith. And if you're stealing, you lack faith. So to wrap up today, hopefully you can see that there's actually a lot packed in this little four-word commandment, thou shalt not steal. We can see that embedded within this law that God endorses possession of material items, land, animals, and goods. Why? As a way to learn how to be a steward like him. We can be guided to respect each other's property as a way to show love to our neighbors. Paul teaches us in the New Testament that we are to steal no longer, but to work, but even more so to give. In this four-word law, God shows us the ultimate contrast between himself and Satan, the giver and the taker. And which one will we model our lives after? Because you see, stealing is a gateway drug, as we saw with Judas. It will corrupt our souls because it is completely against the character of God. And finally, this is a salvation issue. It's a moral and natural law. It is an incredibly relevant to your daily living because at the end of the day, stealing is a faith issue. So therefore, let him who stole steal no longer. Rather, let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he may have something to give him who has need.